Hello, everybody. This is Scott Yates, Director of Communications and Producer Relations for the Washington Grain Commission, here with episode 189 of Weed All About It, or what I'm calling a wake-up call from Lima Grain's Jim Peterson, about my fun, interesting, and provocative conversation with the Vice President of Research at Lima Grain Cereal Seeds, also known as LCS, which is part of a larger French-based cooperative. Jim Peterson and I go way back. It might have been 1998 or 1999 when we first spoke. I was a reporter for the Capital Press when he became the wheat breeder at Oregon State University. Back then, he had a deadpan sense of humor along with a strong commitment to his job. Not a lot has changed in more than 20 years. Interesting fact, Peterson's father, Clarence Pete Peterson, worked with Northwest wheat icon Orville Vogel before going on to become Washington State University's winter wheat breeder. The variety L-Tan was his crowning achievement. For those who might not know the name Vogel, he was the developer of semi-dwarf soft white wheat varieties which dramatically increased yields here and eventually around the world. Gaines was the first semi-dwarf soft white wheat released in 1960. Of course, my point here is that Lima Grain's Peterson and Vogel have a direct connection. Only Peterson chose another path. He could have stayed another dozen years at Oregon State and become a venerated wheat breeder. Instead, he left OSU and 10 years ago this month, he and another colleague, Frank Curtis, opened Lima Grain's first U.S. office for wheat in Fort Collins, Colorado. Peterson, the academic, had plunged into private enterprise. Of a sort. Lima Grain is an agricultural cooperative, but it is a huge one. Started by farmers in 1965 in France, it now has more than 10,000 employees around the world and revenues in excess of $2.5 billion. I don't know if Lima Grain is making money from its U.S. wheat business. I asked Peterson that question and I'm still not sure. But from an outsider's perspective, it appears the company's gamble in planting a foreign seed business on U.S. soil has paid off. Although Lima Grain is active throughout the U.S., more selections are on offer in the Northwest than anywhere else. If you include varieties bred as part of a co-release agreement with university partners, it now has 16 soft white winter varieties available throughout the region. But as you'll hear ahead, Peterson is not thrilled with the pace of the wheat industry's evolution. Both near the beginning of our conversation and again at the end, he betrays his frustration at farmers' willingness, in most parts of the country, to continue doing the same old thing. I begin our conversation by noting the company's anniversary. A lot has happened since Lima Grain opened its doors, but maybe not enough. Peterson sums up the era.
Yeah, it is 10 years. It's been quite an amazing ride since then. Frank Curtis and I opened the doors here in August of 2010. Our first offices, frankly, were in the back storeroom of a Bush facility in Fort Collins, and our internet connection was an air card hanging out the window. So we've come a long way since then. We purchased a few small breeding companies in the Central Plains and East. We hired some really talented staff along the way, opened a Canadian program in 2015, and developed a North American breeding program out of what was a fairly small, innocuous start.
Wow. So Jim, you're the son of Clarence Pete Peterson, a WSU wheat breeder. You were a scientist in Nebraska with the Agricultural Research Service. You were a wheat breeder at Oregon State University. All of your working life was involved with large, academically oriented institutions. What did you have to learn quickly when you came aboard Lima Grain, and what did you learn more slowly?
Well, you know, marketing and marketing strategies was really the first step. And Frank Curtis obviously was a great teacher in that regard. I mean, we ran a pretty commercially oriented program at Oregon State, as you know. But to build those marketing alliances like what we have with GMG have been really, really important to us. To find those folks in the market that are willing to take some risks and believe in what we're doing and help us build the program has been really, really important. So that's been a lot of it. The fundamentals of just running a company budget in that was also a rather quick learn. And I'm still not a very good accountant, by the way. But they realized they didn't hire an accountant, so I guess that's okay. More slowly, you know, I guess Scott, a lot of it is transitions. We all think the industry is going to move faster than it does. We think research is going to evolve faster than it does. The markets will evolve in different directions than what they have. And we all kind of expect that the industry is going to evolve more quickly than it does in terms of public-private relationships, in terms of acceptance of research in the marketplace, in terms of even segregation and management of quality in the marketplace. So a lot of those things have not evolved as maybe as fast as I would expect. Land-grant universities, you know, have been still very much doing what they've always been doing, in spite of the fact that in many ways we'd like to see them do more basic research rather than the commercial-oriented stuff. So transitions are always a difficult thing to predict on timeline, but you know, again, we're working through that as best we can, and we think the industry is still evolving and accepting private technologies and private varieties more readily than they used to.
Well, you know, part of this evolution that you're talking about in Lima Green is that you now have 23 universities that you're in cooperative ventures with. Whose idea was it to partner with universities, and how has it turned out?
Well, this was really a base underlying strategy for how we developed LCS, and obviously that's part of what I brought to the table when we formed the company. We know universities are not terribly good at business. We looked at the tremendous opportunities of partnering with universities to take product to market more efficiently, to develop commercial opportunities from our side that we can exploit and share with them. And so that's been a very important part of what we've been doing from day one. We actually have about 14 or 15 collaborative breeding projects with the universities right now, but exchanges with many, many more than that right now, and brought a number of products to market all over the country. We're sharing the benefits of royalties back with the universities, and have been able to take products that they've developed, that we've co-developed, to market much faster to benefit the growers and the universities as well. So it's been a big part of what we've done. Other companies have done it, maybe a different way, not as extensively as we have, but that was a foundation really what we wanted to build on was those relationships and the public base that we could help bring to market.
So is every contract with every university different, or is it all part of the same template, and how do they differ, if so?
Well, you always start off with some common templates to start, but frankly, all the universities are a little different. They're different people, different priorities, different environments, different tech transfer people, different administrators, different week commissions. So they're all tweaked and different to kind of customize to what's works for the university. You know, in many ways, the one I'm most proud of is our SunGrains relationship with the group in the Southeast, five universities in the Southeast of the U.S. I never thought I'd really get five universities to sign the same piece of paper, but they did, and we've got a neat relationship with that group that's really a regional collaboration, not just a one-on-one with a university.
Now, I believe one of your original collaborators was with the University of Idaho. You know, what is the deal with Idaho, and who does what, and how do you split the proceeds?
Well, nothing simple, of course, of what we've done, but this is an interesting one that, you know, we actually are, it is a co-breeding operation. We're sharing the testing, we're sharing the selection, we're sharing the royalties. And essentially, we're running kind of a parallel program to our own to bring varieties to the market with the university that have different strengths, some different complementary marketing areas and opportunities compared with our own germplasm base. So, you know, the University of Idaho brought some really important things to the table in terms of end-use quality is exceptional, good winter hardiness, complemented what we had in our own program, which was built from more really the French base, the Oregon base, some of that material. And when you bring that all together, it creates a very powerful germplasm base to operate from. And again, some marketing opportunities that we wouldn't have had otherwise.
Okay. There's nothing going on with Washington State University, right?
Well, not completely true. I mean, obviously, WSU is working with us on the coaxium project. They're developing the herbicide-tolerant coaxium varieties at this point in time. And we have continued to exchange material, parental material, with WSU over time. So we're hoping that they'll be an important partner with us in bringing the coaxium program to the forefront in the PNW.
Okay. All right. When it comes to varieties, Jim, how much of the popularity of a particular variety is due to its performance and how much to its marketing?
You know, I really kind of hate to admit this. It's not all about the variety. Marketing is really important. And that's one of the things that I've certainly learned and appreciated with the company. Bad marketing can kill a good variety. And good marketing can take a good variety to an exceptional acreage that we wouldn't have expected necessarily. But part of that also is the breeders have to hit a release window. They have to hit the time for the variety has to be right to take it to market with an identity that creates some enthusiasm in the marketplace. So marketing is important, timing is important, as well as the product, and it's a combination of all three, really.
All right. Now, Jim, I know that Lima Grain has brought in varieties from other regions of the world to see if they'd work in the Northwest. What did that experience teach you about regional differences?
Well, that experience actually is like more a product of the 37 years I've spent in the business to date. The relationships built over time, managing the international nursery that's now done long defunct, research on adaptation zones, coordinating regional trials, even absorbing the Hybridtech program, all of those things create some information and identity on what works and what doesn't work in different areas and different adaptation zones. So a lot of that comes down to experience. And then, yes, of course, we're bringing in lots of material out of the company, largely out of Western Europe, and start to understand better what fits, what doesn't fit, strengths and weaknesses, and there's always issues there as we bring material in. But that base of material, the genetic base, is really important to build off of, and a lot of it is experience, so you don't waste a lot of time and waste a lot of effort.
Now, is every climate everywhere unique? And by that, I mean, it would make sense to me that it would be possible to bring wheat varieties or lines developed in a similar climate to Eastern Washington and make them work here. What's the problem with that common sense approach?
Well, it does work to an extent. And I mean, obviously, the link between the French breeding programs and the Pacific Northwest here has been really important to bringing products quickly to market here and building the base of material. But very rarely do direct introductions actually work in a commercial release situation. Usually the quality is not right when you bring it in from a different area. Oftentimes the stress tolerances aren't quite right in a different area. So a lot of times you bring in material and then you spend several years looking for the weaknesses, trying to make sure that there isn't something underlying that you missed as you brought material in. So very rarely do the direct introductions work. We were lucky here because we also kind of knew what to look for. But more often what happens is you're bringing in some great parents for building the program complementary to what you have. And that's kind of where we're at now is we brought in introductions that are working, doing well. And now we've used them as parents and even built stronger material back out of those with our own internal germplasm base.
Have you taken any Pacific Northwest developed varieties and tried them elsewhere in France or wherever?
We've tried, but you know, interestingly, our varieties in general don't have sufficient disease resistance to go from here back. Also, the different quality specs, of course, we're breeding primarily soft whites. There's no real soft white market in Europe. And our material don't meet uniformity requirements they have in Europe. The absolute tabletop uniformity specs there really would be a problem for us in our varieties direct. So much easier coming this way. taking a French hard red winter, for example, and making a soft white winter out of it is much easier than vice versa.
Interesting, interesting. Where is Lima Grain's greatest penetration in the U.S., and what about in the world?
Well, of course, the Pacific Northwest is our strength right now because we had the experience, the germplasm base to come together quickly to have a market impact fast in the Northwest. Following that, I think our Central Plains program with the new coaxium material rolling out now is going to have a big impact, particularly in Kansas and Oklahoma. And in the international scene, the strength of the program for Lima Grain is really in France and UK and into Germany, that Western European material. And that's what's also been interesting because it's a nice collaboration for us to access that same kind of materials.
Okay, I'm going to get to coaxium in a bit, but as a U.S. startup a decade ago, I have to imagine the parent company in France gave you a certain period of time to begin making money. Can you tell me how much rope they gave you, and are you now meeting their expectations?
Well, it's always the same with almost any program, whether it's a wheat commission or a university or another company. They always give you just enough rope to hang yourself, right? And obviously, 10 years into this, it requires patience to build a breeding program. And we are always being challenged to realign our resources with the market opportunity. And as you know well, Scott, the market is very different now than what it was 10 years ago. We've lost a lot of acreage in the U.S. We've had to shift our resources and our priorities around to make sure that we are aligned with that market. So we're continuing to adapt as best we can to the market, as well as, again, provide them assurances to our parent company that we're doing the right things and making progress. But any kind of a seed company, breeding company, obviously has to have patience because it takes, 8 to 10 years to really take a variety from cross to market and be successful.
So are you making money?
Well, sure, we're making money. We're also spending a lot too, Scott.
Okay. You have good penetration in hard red winter acres of eastern Washington. Is that because of the material you brought in from outside the region, or is it because you have bred for adapted varieties in the Northwest?
Well, it is a bit both, of course. We were lucky, and John Bruno, as our first wheat breeder in the Pacific Northwest, obviously came from France. He knew the French breeding material really well, so he could reach into that program and select materials that were more likely to fit our quality specs for the PNW, as well as have adaptation. So LCS Jet, for example, is a direct introduction from France, but it was a design cross, frankly, that Jean Bruno made before he came here. So it was always intended for the PNW originally. So that's been an important part of being able to bring things over directly, but as a big screening process to make sure we get the quality right, the adaptation right, et cetera. So you do have to have a bit of both in mind, know the material, know the program, and be able to select it appropriately.
So, Jim, you have jumped on, Lima Grain has jumped on the coaxium herbicide resistance trait. Do you think this will be as big as Clearfield?
Well, let's give you just a little bit of background on that, first of all, because it is an interesting relationship we've developed. This is part of a three-way partnership bringing this technology to market. So Colorado Wheat Research Foundation owns the trait, which was developed by Colorado State University. And Alba is our chemical company partner, which develops herbicides and herbicide formulations. And then our role in this is actually to manage the trait and to license it to other breeding entities. So yes, we're developing varieties, of course, and we've been at it for a few years now, but we're also licensing that technologies with universities like WSU and others to bring varieties and product to market. Is it gonna be as big as Clearfield? There are places where it's gonna be more valuable than Clearfield, and a good example, I think, is the Central Plains. We know Clearfield is in the Beyond Chemistry is magic on goat grass, but it is less effective on some of the other grassy weeds, such as cereal rye, downy brome, and cereal rye is really important as a weed problem in southern Kansas and Oklahoma. So we have an opportunity to bring Aggressor to market with the herbicide-tolerant varieties and provide some excellent control. It also, frankly, allows us to respond to some of the shifts in weed pressures that resulted from long-term use of Clearfield in the Pacific Northwest. We did a pretty good job of controlling goat grass over these last 17 years, but we've also seen an explosion of resistant downy brome in the states, and so this will give us an opportunity to control that important weed as well. So yes, we think it's really important. We're obviously looking for lots of opportunities around the country where it's going to fit, but we also know there are places where it's not going to fit. And for example, in the eastern U.S., where there's lots of group one resistance Italian rye out there that will limit the application. So trying to make sure we focus where it fits, where the technology is useful, and trying to maintain it as best we can.
Well, you mentioned the class of chemicals that it belongs to, class one. Now, isn't this class already showing resistance? And aren't you playing with fire here?
There is resistance out there in some weed species, of course, which is, again, why we are not rolling it out in the east, where there is already herbicide-resistant weed species out there. And that is also why we're working so hard on stewardship with ALBA and with CWRF. This is going to be important to the long-term success of the system, just as stewardship was important to the Clearfield program. And, you know, again, we were lucky to have essentially 17 years of a run with Clearfield. We knew eventually it was going to be compromised. But I think what's important now is we want to emphasize rotation of chemistries with our growers. Coaxium can fit into a chemical rotation then that can help extend probably the life of Clearfield technology as well as extend the life of coaxium managed in a rotational system. So that's where we're going with this. We really want to emphasize that technology, that stewardship, that rotation of chemistries with our growers to make sure they get not only value short-term but long-term out of the trade as well.
There were some early variety releases from Lima Grain that had questionable quality, but it does appear as if your quality has improved over the years. Can you tell me about your emphasis on quality and improving the quality of Lima Grain releases?
Well, of course, some of the varieties you're referring to, Scott, are ones that we actually inherited, weren't necessarily bred by us, and some were even introduced before LCS got off the ground. And one of the things that I did when we first got our feet on the ground in Fort Collins was to invest a whole bunch of money in a quality lab. And we have a first-class wheat quality lab here now with Haley Butler, very talented, running our lab as our lab manager here. And we have put a lot of effort onto selecting, screening, and trying to bring better quality material to market. No program is perfect, and programs do make mistakes along the way in terms of release of material you think is good in quality. But I think we've made a lot of progress, and we have some really nice material out there. And some of our varieties now in the Pacific Northwest are in that most desirable category where we want to be. So I'm really pleased with the emphasis by the breeders, contributions of our quality lab, and I think we have come a long way and continue, hopefully, to improve our quality even from where we are now. Now, along with that goes also that other frustration of we put lots and lots of time and effort into quality, but it's still hard to make a lot of money out of quality. You know, we're still a commodity-based industry. We'd love to find better ways to bring quality to market. One of those is the high amylose trait, which we're working on with Bay State Milling right now and hoping to see that trait start to have impact in the market as a true nutritional benefit quality trait that we can deliver in wheat.
That's the starch trait, correct?
That's the starch trait, exactly, that creates a higher level of fiber from a conventional wheat-based product. And we're really excited about bringing that on. It's always difficult in the situation where we've had the COVID shutdown. It's had a big impact on the industry from A to Z. But we're still hoping that will grow quickly over the next several years.
What can we expect from Lima Grain in the next decade?
Breeding has changed so much in the last 10 years even, Scott. You know, when we're looking at the technologies around genomics, around trait delivery, around genomic selection, molecular markers, all of those things have really revolutionized plant breeding to the point where what I learned in the 80s is almost unrelated to what we're doing now in plant breeding. It's really exciting what's coming. It's about going really fast. We're doing things through rapid cycle as quickly as we can, using embryo rescue even to speed up the process. So now delivering varieties to market with new trait combinations are coming faster and faster. And I think we're going to have some unique contributions to the market, which are going to be very exciting in the near future, and hopefully set apart some of our programs with those trait combinations. So we're excited about that. We're excited about our Canadian program, which has come to maturity very quickly, and hopefully get that market off the ground in Canada. And so, yes, I think there's a lot of things coming with technologies behind them growers may not see, but will directly benefit from them, certainly over time.
Anything else you want to add, Jim?
Well, you know, the other thing I might mention is, you know, I go back to when it was 2008, 9, and 10, is when the industry and Darren Kopic kind of raised that flag going, you know, guys, we're losing wheat acreage. We really need to get to reinvest in wheat and wheat breeding and wheat technologies and all those things. And you saw all the companies come back to the table, didn't they? Monsanto got back into wheat. Syngenta upped their game. We came in. KWS came in. Bayer bought Westbred. I mean, all those things happened over the transition over a few years. But yet we're still all kind of struggling. The market hasn't evolved. Save seed is still really, really high everywhere but the Pacific Northwest. And so a lot of the investments have been made, but I think our growers have forgotten we've come to the table. And those technologies, they're really not taken advantage of yet. We still have public programs putting out lots of varieties at very low royalty rates. It's a tough market out there right now between save seed, reducing wheat acreage base right now. And I think the industry needs to think a little more clearly about what are those long-term investments need to look at to keep wheat moving forward. Canada is a good example. I mean, we need to look over the border and what they've been doing in terms of value creation and value capture up there to try to promote development of technologies and increase the return on those investments so that they can continue to be reinvested in wheat over a period of time. So if there's one thing over time that I think the growers need to wake up to is the company's investments can pay off big time for them. Competition in breeding is really, really important. And you can't dismiss the value of having multiple parties, public and private, bringing varieties to the marketplace. And I think they're going to see Canada, if they get the value creation models in place, the seed value use agreements in place, the value of the Canadian royalty market for breeding might be larger than the U.S. market. So where are those investments going to go? I think the industry per se needs to wake up a little bit and see what investments are being made and make sure they continue to support those over time.
I don't know about you, but talking to Peterson gave me a lot of food for thought. I do remember the time period he talked about when private companies stampeded back to the wheat table, but that was also an era of extraordinarily high wheat prices when everybody was talking about a new price paradigm. The market, unfortunately, put the kibosh on such talk, and prices have fallen significantly from that heady time, which no doubt has something to do with the slower-than-expected transition of wheat farming into a new age. This month's bonus podcast, available only at the Washington Grain Commission website, wagrains.org, celebrates harvest with a look back to August 2017 in episode 35 entitled Payday on the Palouse. That's when I conducted an interview with Gary Bailey, chairman of the Washington Grain Commission, from the cab of his Case IH quad-track tractor pulling a bank-out wagon. Listen to how much has changed and how much remains the same after 3 years. Then join me here again next week for another episode of Wheat All About It.
We're all children of a special treat, a miracle of nature that we just call wheat. Crop that's in the Bible, a crop that's in our bread, a crop that's filled salvation in times of want and woe. Wheat has been our savior, our grub, our gruel, our dough. There's always lots of problems when we have enough to eat, but there's only one dilemma when it's not enough wheat. We feed you.